This episode is brought to you by the American Homebrewers Association, a hub for homebrewers since 1978. Visit homebrewersassociation.org for award-winning recipes, brewing tips, and community. homebrewersassociation.org. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, January 16th, 2020. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Scott Janish of Sapwood Cellars and author of The New IPA, A Scientific Guide to Hop Aroma and Flavor, talks about dry hopping strategies for hazy pale ales. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. If you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear. And you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. If you want to support us financially, and we appreciate those who have, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. And thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. There's more stuff coming your way if you are a Patreon supporter. Steve and I are finally going to get together in the next day or so to record video and audio stuff. 2020 has been tricky so far for getting together to record. Looking forward to it, though. It's always good to see Steve, and it's always fun to taste good beer and talk about it with somebody who enjoys the same thing that you do. We got some tasty stuff to sample and talk about. If you'll remember from last week, listener Josh asked for money-saving strategies, especially for brewing small-batch beers, and we've got some feedback for Josh. Seth writes in and says, I think you were spot on with regards to reusing yeast. Yeast is my biggest expense in any given batch, but I've got a library of about 5 strains in my fridge that I reuse time and time again. Seth says, additionally, I would say one of the things that has saved me the most money is to improve and increase my brew house efficiency. The more efficient my process is, the less I have to spend on ingredients. Brew in a bag is simple, efficient, and effective for optimizing my spend and time when homebrewing. I appreciate that, Seth. If you're just making 1 gallon batches, you can also skip the bag altogether and use a colander or a sieve to strain the grains out of your wort. You will have to use a second pot to go from your so-called mash tun into your kettle. But I've done that very successfully. Friend of the show, Scott Kuey, wrote in. Scott says, if fermenters are an issue, you can cover your boil kettle after chilling and pitching with cling film and a big rubber band and ferment in the pot you boiled in. Scott says works really well, but you do have to aerate somehow. Thanks, Scott. That may be a way to step up the size of batches for Josh without having to invest in fermenters right away. Everybody has a different approach to brewing, which is one of the reasons why I enjoy it so much. Casey from our sponsor, Imperial Organic Yeast, has some good news. Casey says there is a new seasonal strain available until the end of February. It's called L09 Que Bueno. Que Bueno creates refreshing light to dark lagers with very clean, low ester aromatic profiles and nice, crisp, and dry finishes. Casey says this strain is not just a great choice for Mexican lagers, but any lager where clean ester profile and dry finish is appropriate. She says, Que Bueno is excellent for brewing Mexican lagers, Vienna lagers, Maibocks, and more. And, you know, we're in lagering season up here in the Northern Hemisphere, you know. We love Imperial Organic Yeast. My stir plate is dusty because I don't use it anymore for 5 gallon batches of moderate gravity beers. Imperial has the highest pitch rate, 200 billion cells. And Imperial Yeast has a recommended shelf life now of 4 months. I can't wait to try L09 Que Bueno. Look for it at your local homebrew shop. I've got a couple of packets set aside for myself, and I'm going to do some research on lagers from south of the border to get some inspiration. Looking forward to using L09 Que Bueno from Imperial Organic Yeast. Let's take a quick look into the mailbag. Tim writes in with something on topic when thinking about Mexican-inspired beers. Tim says, this is a bit too low-key for a disaster show, but I thought you would get a kick out of it. Just a few minutes ago, I was cutting peppers for a jalapeno cream ale my buddy and I have been working on. And Tim says, thanks for the old cream ale show, by the way. It helped a ton in building the recipe. Tim says, when I finished up with the peppers, I threw them in the freezer for later use, checked on my son, who is a year and a half old, to make sure he hadn't found some trouble in the 3 minutes it took to prepare the peppers, and realized I needed to go to the bathroom. Tim says, no, what didn't I mention there? Oh, that's right, washing my hands after handling the peppers. Needless to say, I'm typing this while pretending nothing is wrong for the kid and waiting for the burn to go away. What a nice reminder to always wash your hands after handling peppers, even ones you don't consider all that spicy. Yes, Tim, yes. That's a lesson well learned. I had a similar experience with Carolina Reapers. Even after I washed my hands in what I thought was a thorough way. So, yeah, be careful. Get some gloves. keep the heat down. Hey, our sponsors Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa are running a special in January just for Basic Brewing Radio listeners. So listen up. 20% off beer and wine kits all this month at highgravitybrew.com. Just use the code BB20N20JAN on highgravitybrew.com when you shop for beer and wine kits, and you'll save 20%. That's a great deal. I don't have to tell you. Some of the featured beer kits on highgravitybrew.com this month are Catherine II, Russian Imperial Stout, Boggy Bottom Barley Wine, and Northern Lights Winter Ale. Now, all those are high-gravity beers, so, you know, 20% off of those can save you a bunch. And if you make wine kits, you know that making your own wine is easy, especially compared to beer. And it's less expensive than buying commercial wines. And you get some good stuff. I was trying a wine that I made from a kit last night and compared that to a commercial version, a Pinot Noir, and I liked mine better. With this special, you know, making beer and wine at home with these kits is 20% less expensive. You just have to remember the code. So get a pen out. It's kind of a long one. BB20N20JAN. That's BB20IN20JAN. BB20N20JAN. HighGravityBrew.com is the place for electric brewing solutions and tons of great beer and wine kits, along with everything else you need. BB20N20JAN is the code you need at family-owned and operated HighGravityBrew.com during January for 20% off beer and wine kits. HighGravityBrew.com. Okay, let's talk to Scott Janish about dry hopping delicious hazy pale ales. Scott Janish, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thanks for having me back again.
This is our third conversation, I believe, based on chapters of your book, The New IPA, A Scientific Guide to Hop Aroma and Flavor. If you're brewing the new IPAs, you need to get this book, right?
I think so. I'm a little biased, but yeah.
Now, I'm intimidated because this chapter the chapters on dry hopping, there's a ton of information in there. And you and I both went out on Facebook and asked people for questions. So we got lots of questions. We got lots of notes. You sent me some notes and I got my own notes. So I'm afraid that, you know, we're not going to hit everything. But the good thing is that everything is in the book. So you need to get the book. If we miss something, they just need to read.
You're right. It is just a lot of information. And sometimes it's kind of hard to grasp. I actually listened to the dry hopping chapter book on tape today at the gym, which is not very motivational when you're running on the treadmill to hear about humulones and alpha acids, but I got to remember everything here.
Well, if the audiobook guy was able to pronounce, is it humulones?
Yeah, that's why I didn't do it myself. I can't do all that. Yeah, humulones. Humulones.
Again, get the book.
Not easy. Yep.
Now the first thing, the very first thing, in everything, it seems like oxygen is the big enemy. Let's see if I can find the ones that the questions that mentioned. Here we go. Dimitri on Facebook, recommendations or techniques to avoid oxidation during dry hopping on the homebrew level, especially when you dry hop cold, for example, at 10C, as you recommended in your recent article. I guess you wrote an article on your blog.
Yep. Recently, trying to make a case for cooler and shorter dry hop durations, which I'm sure we'll hit on quite a bit.
Yeah, those things are on my list, those factors, but first of all, why should we avoid oxidation or exposure to oxygen at the stage where we're dry hopping?
Well, I mean, I think most brewers understand that oxygen in any style is, gonna negatively impact beer, but especially in hazy IPAs, which are just so sensitive to oxygen, and they can go downhill pretty quickly. I mean, you can visually see a hazy IPA go from, a nice straw hazy color to a darker version of itself in a matter of days if it has little oxygen at packaging. And if you're going to be dry hopping, particularly after primary fermentation is over, this is when trying to avoid any oxygen uptake is the most important. Because if you're, say you're adding dry hops at day 3 or 4 and there's still a little bit of fermentation going on, and you open up that fermenter and drop in the hops, hopefully that active fermentation will kind of scrub whatever oxygen gets introduced from just that short little time it takes to drop in the hops. But if you're doing it on day 7 or 8, fermentation's done, the yeast is pretty much settled out, and you open up that fermenter, and that's oxygen is, in direct contact with the beer. And this might even be more important for home brewers because, I mean, if you open up, like for example, at Sapwood, we have like 4-inch ports on our 10-barrel tanks, and so that's 4 inches when we open up the drop in hops, in contact with, 300 plus gallons of beer. Where if you have a bucket at home and you have 5 gallons of beer and you open up the cover to that bucket, that oxygen is getting introduced to just 5 gallons, versus a smaller opening for us on 300 gallons. So the professional level, you're getting a little more dilution of oxygen with beer. So this is especially important for smaller homebrew batches to try to avoid oxygen pickup. There's a number of ways to do it. I've experimented with just purging the headspace while you open up the fermenter. So if you have, I mean, you could even just, take a hose and hook it to your CO2 tank and essentially just run like 10-15 PSI in that headspace while you drop in the hops real quick. That, I mean, it's not a perfect solution, but it's at least something. Another great way to avoid oxygen when dry hopping is to just move the beer into a keg that already has hops in it, especially if you can do a closed transfer. I worked with a company when I was home brewing to try to come up with a solution to dry hop loose in kegs. The reason being, and I think this was a question that was asked to both of us online, is dry hopping loose versus dry hopping in a tight bag or a there's like stainless steel canisters that you can buy that you can drop hops in. If you have them in a bag, there's some research that shows you can get as much as 50% less extraction of some of the volatile oils if they're tight in a space like that versus just loose in the beer. So that's kind of the reason I was trying to find a way to both, dry hop loose as well as try to have hardly any oxygen pickup. So I worked with this company called Utah Biodiesel that created a filter for your dip tube. So it's a 300 micron filter that goes around your dip tube, and it goes into, I believe it's a 6 or 6.5 inch silicone drilled stopper. So the dip tube goes through that stopper, and then that stopper goes into the filter, and then that goes around, makes a tight seal around your dip tube. So you can just toss the hops in to your keg loose, and then you can close that keg up and purge it a number of times, like go up to 15 psi, psi about, I don't know, 3 or 4 times each time, removing most of the oxygen that's in there, and then, rack in. So that's a good way to both purge the hops themselves, as well as the container it's going in, and then a closed transfer in is a is another plus to try to remove oxygen intake. So I guess that's kind of a long answer to a couple ways.
You ticked a couple of items off the list there.
Yeah.
Andy from Facebook says, caged, bagged, or loose, does caging or bagging have an impact on the extraction of oils slash aroma? And Alexander says, sack or no sack? If so, do we weigh down the sack? Do we squeeze the sack? Well, that's a personal issue, I think. But,
Yeah, that's right. I definitely wouldn't squeeze the sack, because then you'd have to do that above the beer, and that just sounds like a really good way to have oxygen intake, and another way to, if you're using your hands or what, it just doesn't seem like a good idea. As well as removing the bag from the hops to even squeeze it means you got to open the fermenter up again and splash it a little bit by squeezing it. So I definitely wouldn't do that, but.
When you think about it, I mean, when you put the hops in the beer, those pellets, if you're using pellets, they swell up, and then you've got this big ball of hops. And if they're in a bag or if they're in one of those mesh cylinders, it seems like to me that the beer doesn't get exposure to anything but the outside surface of that blob of hops.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I remember a while back I wrote something on this, and I kind of used the analogy of, like, if you've ever tried to wash like a giant bedspread and put it in the dryer, and the outside gets dry and the inside's still real wet. I mean, it's the same kind of thing, but kind of flipped here. For example, we've done a lot of dry hopping with like sour beers at the brewery, and we'll sometimes fill one of those little 300 micron canisters. We'll unscrew the cap and fill it half full of pellets, dry hop for a couple days, and when I clean out that keg and I pull out that canister and I'm dumping out the hops, the first of all, it's like full. I filled it half full, but after it gets wet and those pellets expand, it fills up that canister, and when you're dumping it out, there's whole pellets still in there that smell great. They're pretty much intact, and that's you never want to, when throughout the brewing process, especially with hoppy beers, if you smell something really great, usually that's not the best sign. You want that to be in the beer. So dry hopping loose is always, in my experience, it works better. And then there's also some studies that show that sensory end as well as just measured oils are increased.
If you are dry hopping loose, and say you're dry hopping in the serving vessel, you're not getting those back out, right? I mean, is that good or is that bad?
It kind of de I mean it kind of depends on what you're after. I mean, I definitely, when I was doing a lot more homebrewing, I would leave hops in contact with the beer in the serving vessel for the duration. I was also dry hopping at a little lower rates than I was today, which I think is helpful if you're going to be doing that. There's just you're going to get If you're dry, I mean, I guess we can get into some of the. There are some questions on, like, how the temperature to dry hop and all that. But you can, if you're dry hopping at serving temperature, you're still going to get extraction. But the longer that those hops sit, the more you can pick up some of the compounds from the hops that you may not necessarily want in the beer.
Yeah, I dry hopped with cryo hops, and I haven't used cryo hops a lot, so I put them in the bag that I usually use for pellet hops, And then, you know, I followed your advice and, you know, just dry hopped for a couple of days, and I pulled the bag out and they were gone. You know, the hops were, they went right through that mesh, those cryo hops. So I went ahead and kegged the beer, and the bitterness was kind of sharp for the first couple, 3 days. And then, but now it's mellowed out. You know, they were Amarillo, and now it's kind of a stone fruit kind of, you know, tropical fruit character, whereas in the beginning it was, you know, kind of a sharper bitterness along with that. And I don't know if that was just hop residue that settled to the bottom of the keg and I just, you know, drank it in the beginning or what. So, you know, yeah. if you don't have it in a bag, you have less control over contact time, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you could always transfer, you know, into another serving vessel if you want to do something like that, just to get it off the hops. I don't know. In your case, was it a really fine mesh bag, or is it one of those mesh bags that you would use for like grain?
Well, it wasn't as fine as I thought. I like I say, it's usually, you know, that just that. Mesh is usually enough to, you know, to hold the pellet hops in, but then the cryo hops just went right through. So I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, the cryo hops do have less of the, you know, the whole point is to have less of the vegetal material. And in my experience, and even talking to some other, brewers, the cryo hops will stay in suspension a little better and a little longer, than the traditional pellets like the T90s. And it's, and I, you know, I speculate that that's probably to do with, you know, they're finer, almost a little more powderier, so they'll stay in solution a little better, which is a good thing for extraction, and that the more vegetal properties of a hop probably, you know, in summarizing a little too much, but probably just it's heavier, so it sinks out a little quicker. So that could be part of it. And then, you know, dry hop beer in general just takes, you know, a lot longer, and I think a lot of people realize to settle out and get that hop burn out of there. To really have a more drinkable beer.
Now, you mentioned, you know, going from one serving vessel to another. You know, again, you have to worry or be concerned about purging with CO2 and avoiding oxygen contact there as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we if we're filling, like we do a lot of what we call like variants, which is essentially that, like you're taking 15 gallons, you know, a half barrel keg, of already done beer and jumping it into another keg that has, you know, vanilla beans, coconut, or even more dry hops. And we'll take that receiving keg and purge it, you know, 3 or 4 times, and then try to almost match the PSI of the serving keg. So whatever keg is coming in, they're almost exactly the same so that the beer doesn't just rush in. And then you just slowly release pressure as you're jumping back into that keg. But it is a good way to get, you know, cleaner serverable beer, and then get it off, you know, hops in this case.
And we're talking about, you know, contact with, you know, beer and the hops, the dry hops. In addition to, you know, considering adding the hops loose, you say that agitation is another way that you can increase the contact or contact between the beer and the hops.
Yeah, agitation can both speed up the extraction as well as increase the extraction. For homebrewers, it can be as simple as just picking up your carboy and just kind of giving it a gentle swirl. Because really, if those dry hops are sitting at the bottom of your vessel, they're not really doing anything for you. They're not extracting into the beer, so you kind of want to encourage them to get back into solution to start extracting their oils. At the brewery, we'll pump, we'll do like short blasts of CO2 through the cone once a day for a couple days, just to try to get those to blurt back into suspension, which you could actually do as a homebrewer too. I know a lot of people will ferment in a keg, and you could shoot some CO2 through your dip tube, just to kind of, you know, blast all the hops that might have settled back into suspension. But the research is pretty interesting in this. There's, you know, recirculating is one way a lot of professional brewers will do this. So essentially, immediately after dry hopping, you run the beer out of your tank through a pump, and then you go right back into your tank. So you're just kind of moving the beer in a closed environment right back into the tank. And some of the research has found that you can get almost, I think it's 50% higher extraction or higher than that. Actually, it was closer to 60 from, if I'm remembering the paper right, that was, you know, just for 2 hours after adding the dry hops, there was a almost 60% increase in extraction just by recirculating for 2 hours. And one paper even found that recirculating for 6 hours had the same hop intensity scores in a sensory panel compared to a beer that was dry hopped for 4 days. But this also has come at the expense of more greener, more astringent characteristics, which I sort of speculate that if you're recirculating too much, you might almost be, in a way, over extracting the hops, getting more of those greener compounds, especially polyphenols that can add to astringency. So this actually is not something we've done much experimentation with, but I'm curious to start doing even like 15, 20-minute recirculation after adding dry hops, and maybe just with the first charge, just to see if what kind of impact it might have.
Yeah, in a lot of these areas, it seems like there's a Goldilocks effect of, there's too little, and then there's too much, and then there's a sweet spot right in the middle. Like timing, for example, we've got lots of questions on timing. Frank says best dry hop schedule for a NIPA. I do a double dry hop with 1/3 of the total amount during active fermentation and 2/3 from day 5 until day 10. Is this the right way? Tim says, is it best to remove the dry hops after a certain length of time? John says, any issues with adding hops to the fermenter at yeast pitching time? And Christopher says, does double dry hopping really help? And also, Graciandi maybe says, is it really worth it to double or triple dry hop? So those are all about timing. And so when should we put those dry hops in, and what are the advantages and disadvantages?
I mean, I think it kind of depends on what you're looking for. I know we will sometimes, you know, one of those questions was, can you essentially dry hop the same time you're pitching yeast? So that would be like the same day you're knocking out, you're adding dry hops. We do this for some of our beers at Sapwood, but only if it's going to be a beer that we're not going to harvest that yeast, because those the hops will eventually settle out with the yeast trub that you, or with the yeast and the trub that you would harvest for future batches, and you don't want that. But you're also going to lose a whole lot of the hop character by adding them on day one. You're especially the what's called like the hydrocarbons. So these are the more volatile, greener compounds that just the act of fermentation is going to be pushing those out of the beer. But you could still be left behind with some of the more polar, they're called monoterpene alcohols that generally lead to a lot of the fruity flavors that you get in beer. So early dry hop additions can, in my opinion, add a little bit of just, you sneak in maybe a little bit of hop saturated flavor, but you're not going to get a lot of that green, sharp, fresh dry hopped character.
One advantage of putting the dry hops in while the yeast is still active, as we said before, is that the yeast can scrub some of that oxygen.
Yeah, definitely. And I think one of those questions was, I think somebody said they dry hop I think in two or three rounds, and one of them was, it sounded like when there's still some active fermentation. I still think we don't always do that at the brewery, but you know, it's two different beasts when you're brewing at home and brewing at the brewery. There's just different variables to consider. But if I were brewing at home still, I think I would still be adding a dry hop charge during the tail end of fermentation. You could just, for one, you get some hops in, because you're probably not going to be harvesting that yeast. You can always just build up a starter beforehand, or overbuild your starter beforehand and then steal some of the yeast for future batches. So you can dry hop during active fermentation and not worry about harvesting that yeast. By adding it during active fermentation, you're reducing some of the chance of oxygen pickup. And then you might also be scrubbing some of the greener, harsher compounds. Polyphenols can attach to some of the yeast. You might be pushing out some of the myrcene, which is a very green resinous compound that's usually one of the majority compounds of hop oils. And then you might be pushing out some more of the fruitier compounds as well, but you can always do one or two more dry hop charges later. And there's some science around why you'd want to do that too. You can get increased extraction of hop compounds if you're breaking up into smaller hop charges. So rather than putting in, you know, one dry hop charge of, let's say, 10 ounces or something in 5 gallons, you're going to get a lot less extraction than if you're going to be breaking that into three smaller dry hop charges. But again, if you're going to be dry hopping three times on the homebrew level, you need to make sure that your the procedures you use for not getting oxygen in are really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're in the book, you talk about the disadvantages that you get when you put too much dry hops in there. So how do you figure out how much hops to put in there? And I guess we know that if you don't put enough, you don't get enough of a hop character. But what are the disadvantages of putting too much?
Too much, in my opinion, and I've said this before, but my complaint about a lot of hazy IPAs is they're overly astringent, overly green. And this is, in my opinion, just overly dry hopped. If you're dry hopping at rates that are too high, I think you lose some of the varietal specific flavors you get from the hop. For example, if you dry hop Citra, 6 ounces and 5 gallons versus, let's say, something crazy like 20, you're just going to get like a generic green hop flavor and aroma in that heavily hopped one, rather than that fresh kind of citrus thing you love about Citra. And for whatever reason, I still don't know for sure. I think this is especially true if there's not enough hot side hops being used, especially just late in the whirlpool. If you're doing almost all late dry hopping and hardly anything on the hot side, it just seems like that astringent character takes over, and there's no hop saturated flavor to sort of back it up and carry it through. But in terms of how much is the perfect amount, I mean, it's so tough to say. There's one paper that a lot of people look at. It's a great one, and it was at I think they looked at Cascade hops, and they found that if they did about seals like four to doing the math to get to a homebrew batch of like 4 to 5 ounces. In a 5 gallon batch, that's when Cascade had highest scores for citrus flavors. Sensory panel liked it more. And if they started going much higher than that, they started to get more herbal and tea characteristics. Hmm. And so that's just with Cascade. And that's also, a relatively low alpha acid hop. But there's research that shows that higher alpha acid hops might actually not extract as well in beer, just because those alpha acids aren't being isomerized and almost repel liquid a little bit. But that's something I'd love to see more research in.
And there's a whole chapter on dry hopping and bitterness. You said that dry hops can actually lower the amount of isomerized alpha acid, in other words, the bitterness in the beer. But then the dry hops, depending on their age and oxidation of the hops themselves, that can also have an impact on the perceived bitterness of the beer too.
Yeah, it's dry hopping. You almost get astringency and bitterness in two ways. It's just like you said, the leaf material and hops themselves can actually pull out isomerized alpha acids from the hot side. It's, just think of it as like they're just being consumed by the hops themselves and then being left behind. But it's being replaced by humulones, which are a bittering acid, just like alpha acids. But they aren't as, sensory wise, they're not as bitter. I believe that it's about 66% as bitter as one isomerized alpha acid. And there's been some research by John Paul May from Hopsteiner that these are actually, this bitterness is sensory wise a little easier on the palate, a little smoother. But if you're dry hopping heavily, in my opinion, too many of these humulones, along with the increased amount of polyphenols you'll get from heavy dry hopping, can actually come across as like it's an astringent character that it's sort of bitter, but it just lingers. And lingering astringency and bitterness can definitely get in the way of some of that hop saturated flavor that I think most brewers are after. Some of the, like you mentioned, cryo hops earlier. A lot of the vegetal material is removed from those, so in theory they should have less of an impact on pulling out some of those hot side isomerized alpha acids, as well as hopefully not contributing as many polyphenols. But that's still something I'd like to see researched a little more.
And you said that there was a study that indicated that hop aroma actually increases the perceived bitterness of beers as well.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. I'm not really sure what to do with it, other than it's just, and it kind of makes sense. I mean, if you smell a grapefruit and then someone gives you an orange, you'd probably think it's more bitter. I've never actually done that, but the smell of hops are kind of bitter, and so that makes sense. So it's tricky. There's so much information. And sometimes the studies don't always agree with each other, but it's fun to use it to try to just do experiments a little and see what you get.
You talk a lot about dry hopping and pH. How does dry hopping affect the pH of beer, and should it matter all that much?
Yeah, this is actually one I'm kind of interested in now, and I might do some little trials with just finished beer. But heavily dry hopped beers, particularly hazy IPAs, usually have a higher pH than other beers. And this is because, and again, this is a Hopsteiner May study that found that dry hopping raises the pH of beer. It's about 0.14 units per pound of dry hops. So, like 5 ounces in 5 gallons might raise the pH, 0.28 units or so. That's, of course, an estimate, because it really depends on where your starting pH is when you add the dry hops to see how much it would raise. But it's important because there's research that shows that the higher the beer's pH, the higher the sensory bitterness can be. And so if you're, dry hopping extremely heavily, and then you're adding, just raising the pH can increase the bitterness perception, as well as, you're adding more humulones, which is increased the bitterness. You're also adding more polyphenols, which can increase their astringency, which sometimes, in my opinion, is similar to a bitterness type of flavor. But so it's interesting to look at pH to see how can we alter it a little bit to get a more drinkable beer. I know right now all we really do at the brewery is, we usually, if we're going to do an IPA or double IPA, we'll start with trying to just hit a pretty low mash pH, like 5.1 or so. And that's just in hopes that, maybe we're setting the stage for a slightly lower final beer pH, so that the heavy dry hops won't increase it too much. But there's, going back to some of the work that, and in fact, I actually sent an email to Dr. John Paul Mave to get some insight into this. And they've done some research where New England IPAs actually had slightly lower pHs on average than West Coast style IPAs, which is surprising to me. And they think it probably has something to do with the vegetal material and the hops maybe pulling out some of the vegetative matter itself is actually raising the pH is what they're estimating. So that could mean that like cryo and T45 hops might not impact the pH as much, which is interesting. And also there's just the higher the pH from heavily dry hops has also shown to reduce the head retention a little on beer. And this is, so that's some hazy IPAs can have pretty poor head retention. And that could be one reason why, as well as just the longer beer is in contact with dry hops, the worse head retention has been shown. So I think it's, not a negative impact after about 2 days, but then from day 3 to 8, it just keeps declining. So it's another reason to maybe consider getting dry hops off beer relatively quickly. But back to the pH, they actually added sulfuric acid to finished beers. So they had beer that was finished at a pH of 4.9, which is pretty high. I don't think you'll get quite that high with a lot of these heavily dry hop beers, but you might get pretty close to that. And they dropped the pH to 4.5 with sulfuric acid. And then they had a sensory panel look at it. And they found that the lower pH beers didn't taste as good. So they don't know if it was just because of the type of acid they used. Maybe if they used lactic acid, it might have been a different result. But this is a pretty easy thing to experiment with because you can just use finished beer and then dose in a little, for example, lactic acid and do a blind taste test and see which one you like. And if you like the lower pH, then maybe post fermentation, dry hopping, doctoring of the pH levels is worth exploring.
We touched on it, but have we talked a lot about temperature? We talked about time, we talked about amounts, but we haven't talked a bunch about dry hopping temperature, have we?
No, we haven't.
Maybe we should.
I'm a fan of at least experimenting with slightly lower temperatures when it comes to dry hopping. Almost all the dry hopping we do at the brewery starts at around 58 degrees, and that's kind of the temperature that's considered like the soft crash. That's enough to get the yeast to start settling out. I like to get the yeast out of the beer before dry hopping on on bigger volumes, professional volume levels. And that 58 degrees helps do that, but the research has shown that even at cooler temperatures, you're still getting extraction, and you're still getting pretty quick extraction with hops. And there's other benefits to cooler dry hopping, especially if there's still even a little bit of active fermentation. Warmer temperatures can actually remove some more of the hop compounds. If the beer is warmer and there's a little more fermentation, there's some research. This mostly revolves around hop thiols, but the cooler the fermentation temperature, the more hop thiols from dry hops was retained, which is why I did an article not too long ago about a good friend, Spencer Love, actually brewed the beer for me based off some of the research. And this was like a lager that we fermented cooler, but and also had it like wine yeast. This is kind of a more of a bio transformation experiment. But the research showed that the cooler the beer ferments, the more these hop thiols, which are pretty potent, can remain in the beer. So keeping the beer cold with hop contact is in that regard, one reason to do it. But although that's active fermentation, and we're talking more post-fermentation. Other factors, hop creep, for example, is another area where if you're dry hopping cooler and you're dry hopping for shorter durations, you'll have less of a chance of that happening, which for us on the commercial scale is very important. You don't want diacetyl or something like that coming up with after dry hopping.
Andrew on Facebook asked, he had the shortest question with maybe the longest answer, because you have a chapter in the in the book. Andrew just says, explain hop creep. So so that could be another show. I don't know. But, yeah. But give us the elevator pitch for hop creep.
Sure. Hop creep, it's essentially, so there's enzymes in hops. You know, think of them similar to when you're mashing the enzymes that help free up fermentable sugars. There's a few in hops themselves that when you're dry hopping, and I think this is especially true when you have high levels of dextrins, which hazy IPAs, New England IPAs generally do. Dextrins are, unfermentable sugars, essentially, that will leave the beer sweeter. Which New England IPAs are generally pretty sweet. We're finishing usually around 1.020 or so in a lot of these beers. Mm. So there's a lot of dextrins there. And when you're dry hopping, these enzymes can start to work on those and free them up. And this makes them fermentable by yeast. And so if you've already removed the yeast from the beer, if you've dropped the cone, for example, the little bit that's still in there can start working on these newly freed sugars, and then you could start having unhealthy re-fermentation, which could lead to off flavors like diacetyl. Mm. If you've packaged the beer, you might see a rise in your CO2 levels, which can be an issue. But yeah, like you said, in the book, there's a whole chapter on it, and I asked around and to other breweries to get advice on what they do, and then what some of the research has said on the topic. And essentially, the warmer the beer is dry hopped, the more active these enzymes will be, and the longer the hops are in contact, the more that they can work. So shorter duration at cooler temperatures is generally better.
Hmm. So essentially, hop creep, you put the hops in, the enzymes break down the sugars or the starches into sugars more. Any yeast that's still around says, oh, we get to eat again. And then you start eating again. And so you gain a little more alcohol, you lose a little gravity, and you might gain some unhealthy side flavors or off flavors from that sort of secondary, maybe sickly fermentation.
Yeah, exactly. And I think homebrewers don't have to worry as much, because generally you're not dropping out all the yeast, and so you probably have a fairly healthy re-fermentation, but you just have to be patient enough to let it go. And I do wonder, going back to earlier when there's the question on like day one dry hopping, if some of those enzymes are working the whole time and are actually leading towards a lower finishing gravity, as if you didn't dry hop on day one, that would be kind of something fun to test at some point.
Well, Scott, we've covered a lot of ground, and I'm relieved.
You didn't have to be scared.
Well, it helps I'm talking to somebody who knows what he's talking about, and that's what often happens on this show. I can hide my ignorance by just asking questions, and so.
I have to, I thanked everyone in the acknowledgments in the book, but most of the people that wrote these papers and did these studies are much, much smarter than I, and then I emailed them and bugged them quite a bit to make sure I was understanding what they were doing correctly. So I know what it feels like to be intimidated by the results of some of this work.
Well, I appreciate your taking the time again. Again, the book is The New IPA, A Scientific Guide to Hop Aroma and Flavor. And the brewery that you run with our friend Mike Tonsmeyer, the Mad Fermentationist, is Sapwood Cellars. And where y'all at?
We are in Columbia, Maryland, so kind of right in between Baltimore and D.C.
There you go. One day I hope to make a pilgrimage there to taste your wares fresh off the tap.
Please do. I'd love to have you.
Thanks, Scott.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. This is always fun.
Well, thanks again to Scott. Scott's blog is scottjanish.com, scottjanish.com. And his book is The New IPA, A Scientific Guide to Hop Aroma and Flavor. Just chocked full of good information. Always fun to talk to Scott as well. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com and just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. It's all until next time. Till then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production up for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. Talk to you next time, everybody. So long.